With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
What's up, everybody? It's Joe LaPuma. You are listening to the Complex Sneakers Podcast. As always, I am joined by my two co-hosts. First off, Matt Welty. How are you, buddy?
We're live and direct.
We are. You sound crisp. The AC is okay. You're drinking Dunkin' Donuts coffee. You seem like the technical difficulties, the apartment hang-ups, it seems like we're in a good vibe right now.
I think once the weather goes back to, like, being cool this morning, your whole level-headedness goes to the same temperature. You know?
Okay, and of course, my guy, Brendan Dunn, how you doing, buddy?
I am not level-headed at all right now. I am guilty. I am full of remorse. I have sins to atone for. It was a long weekend.
Yeah, but you got the Bach bag. But
hold on, we're going to get to that. We are going to get to that. Let us build up to that. Is that a sewing machine in the back?
Yeah, I'm in my brother's studio right now.
Okay. You coming out with Cut and Sew for the fall?
He's making his own shirts. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, he's deconstructed a couple shirts and put them back together, and I think he's investing in a pattern or two, so he just wants to be a little more self-sufficient.
Okay. Maybe he designs
the Dunn Bros Cut and Sew may hit 2021. Wait for that.
Maybe he designs a Complex Sneakers Podcast merch.
We could do it.
All right. Save on the margins.
I was wondering because for those obviously you can't see, but there's a bottle of like Elmer's glue, it looks like, right next to it. And I thought Brendan Dunn was making like the high school home ec sweatshirts where you had to like glue the like patches and decals onto them.
Yeah. Did you guys have to build the step stool in home ec?
No. I think home ec for me in 7th or 8th grade was a lot of cooking. Maybe a little bit of sewing.
Yeah, maybe I was thinking about something else. Yeah, it was cooking. Home ec was fun, but I had to build like a wooden step stool. Everyone had to do it. It's like every house in our school district had the step stool, and they were beautiful. Mine was the worst one. I am not a handyman at all. So I wouldn't bode well with the sewing machine, the glue, or anything like that.
Nor I. That's all him.
I think I had to make a sweatshirt from scratch, and I just wasn't paying attention while I was doing it. And I definitely sewed the neck opening closed.
Wow.
And when it was all done, I was like, oh, can't wait.
That was the end of your How to Make It in America story?
Yes.
Speaking about How to Make It in America and building something from scratch, let's talk about the New Deal alert, one of our co-hosts. Okay? You like that? I know you like the transition, but this ain't about me. We saw the photo. I love the photo. It looked like old, what was it? Old Reebok boxes, or are those the new ones, or
some,
what?
Some old and new, just some stuff that I've been sitting on, you know? It's Complex staff photographer David Cabrera came by, and we got the lighting for you. You see that's in the new crib, and you see the lighting is angelic.
I like the creative direction. I said that in the Slack. It was a good announcement. I like the creative direction, but the deal, long time coming. Can you give us any details about it?
Yeah, so basically I'm working with Reebok on a few pieces of content, a few videos that are coming out over the next 6 months or so, roughly, promoting some upcoming collaborations that they have. And you should be seeing one very soon. We had to shoot a lot of it at home, Zoom style, so it doesn't look exactly how we would like it to look if we could be on location. But I hope you enjoy the interviews, and I hope you enjoy the product they're promoting. This is a branded deal.
Okay. Are you allowed to wear other products?
Oh, yeah.
Not exclusive. He got the not exclusive deal? Okay.
People on my social media need to understand this. Yes, I will still be wearing other sneakers. I like a lot of other sneakers. I do not walk around exclusively in Reebok. I guess it's just a meme at this point, so that's what people expect. But I have a lot of sneakers. Not all of them are Reeboks. I enjoy a lot of sneakers. Not all of them are Reeboks.
Okay.
This is how you know it's serious. Hit up Brendan Dunn this morning asking him about the payment that we both should have received on something else for Full Size Run. And he's like, I don't know if it hit. It's hard to discern with all the money coming in.
Wow.
From Reebok.
Okay.
And I was like, oh, I guess the bag's different.
Whenever someone says, oh, I'd have to check, different level. Oh, I'd have to check.
Stop it.
Okay. Did the wire hit? We don't know because the wires are getting conflated. Okay. The wires are getting crossed.
I need to do my part. You know, they sent me a bunch of shoes for the photo shoot. I got to give some of those away. Don't ask me. Don't DM me. I will figure it out. But I really need to give back right now because, like I said, I have some sins to atone for. I need to balance out my karma at the moment.
Oh, yeah? What's that?
I told you guys.
Oh, before we go, just get me a Reebok DMX-10 that I've been asking for years, please. Now, I got to ask, all right?
For you, yes, Joe. For Thank the you. Random people I don't know on Appreciate social media, it. No. But okay.
Let's hear it. What's going on about you? What's going on with the sin?
Yeah, my heavy heart. You've known I've been moving into this new place. I'm pretty much settled, but we rented a U-Haul this past weekend to go pick up some tasteful furniture, you know, a vintage Italian chair, a nice smoked Lucite amber table. Yes, some other tasteful things. We rented the U-Haul van and I was driving around an undisclosed avenue in an undisclosed section of Brooklyn. And, you know, the U-Haul van is pretty manageable. It's not as big as a truck, but you're still a little wide.
Okay.
And, you know, I'm focused.
Hit and run? Sorry, go ahead. I don't want to step on your thing, but I see where this is going. Go ahead.
You know, it's wider. The van is wider than you think, especially with the mirrors out.
I can tell this is a classic misjudging of a small space, but keep going.
Listen, I'm laughing, but I don't feel good about this. I definitely blew somebody's mirror right off their car.
Did you leave a note?
Did you report it to the police?
I was very focused and I didn't know what to do. I kept driving. This is not funny, but I kept driving because I had the van for a limited amount of time and I was very in mission mode. And I was asking my brother who was sitting passenger, what should I do? What should we do? And will their insurance cover it, et cetera? I didn't leave a note. I left their mirror in the street.
Oh, bro.
But I did. Let me tell you this. We did circle back around and I went out of my way to go back down that avenue and look for the truck whose mirror I blasted off. And I've been racked with guilt since. So I need to figure out how I can give back to the universe in order to right this misdeed because I'm not proud of myself.
Did you just confess? Yes. Did you just confess to a crime?
I confessed to the crime because listen, if the person whose mirror I destroyed is out there.
Okay, that's fair. Yes.
And you can share some details corroborating your involvement in the incident. I will be happy to give you the money or make it right in whatever way I can. That's the best I can do right now. In the moment, I should have stopped.
Man, listen.
Do you think Reebok will take away my deal because of this?
I'm just kind of trying to figure out how sincere you are.
I'm totally sincere.
Did you put enough time? Did you put as much time searching for the van that you hit as you did into the Reebok announcement photo post? Okay. Did you circle the block?
I keep laughing,
a few times?
But I'm not. Okay.
Joe, there's a lot of things I would trust Brendan on. I would go to him for advice. You know, Magic the Gathering cards. Certain things. How to get into the back end of like a retailer's website.
Yep.
But if there's like some sort of situation where you're like, hey, we're moving and we need someone to drive like a commercial size vehicle.
No go.
And no offense. It's like Brendan's not really the guy that I'm going
100%
to. It's like my grill broke. It's like, I'm not going to call Brendan to be like, hey, how do I fix this in the backyard?
100%. Right. I am not offended in the least. Totally fair assessment. Totally accurate. You are right in that. I'm not the guy to call.
So not a good driver.
I wrecked a car once when I was a teenager, but I'm not the worst driver. But you know, commercial vehicles. I don't have a the van is wide.
You don't got a CDL.
But I'm happy to lift some couches and things like that if you need some muscle.
All right, shifting gears. Well done. We hope.
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
You're sorry, and we hope that the person gets in touch because we know you're a guy of.
One last. Do you think that their insurance will cover it? I was going to Google it, but I didn't want to incriminate myself further with my cookies and all that.
I'm not sure. I don't know how that works, honestly. Anyway, shifting gears, we hope that they get in touch with you and you do the right thing. Let's talk you know, we've been on New Balance for a few weeks on this podcast, but I feel like the Slack was as energetic as it's ever been.
On
because
fire.
Yeah, let's give the audience a little take. We're working on a post, the best 992s of the year or in general or what of the year?
Of 2020.
Of 2020.
Yeah.
And man, was that Slack, the Complex Sneaker Soul Collector Slack, a lot of different opinions. And I say that because there was a lot of back and forth. And Dunn, I think we have to say the Packer shoes 992, it landed in your apartment.
Yes. And yours.
Yes.
It's right behind you.
Thanks so much to Packers.
Not mine.
Great in person, right? Better in person, man. Better in person.
It's a lovely shoe.
So the 992s. Welty, you had a lot of strong opinions. There was some jarring back and forth for the audience. We don't usually tease content. We're very like surprised. The element of surprise is a gift, but we haven't been able to run this list because we're all over the map as to the rankings of the best 992s of 2020. And as this goes up, I would love to see what the audience thinks. So when this podcast goes up, drop a line of your favorite 992s in our comments. But well, do you talk about, or Dunn, hop in and talk about, you saw the level of contention rising and rising.
No. I want to let Welty take it away because I feel passionately about this, but nobody feels more passionately about this than Welty. As he should. I think he's the most engaged with New Balance out of all of us. He loves the brand the most. I'm a huge New Balance fan, but Welty even more so. Welty, do you feel like no one was listening to you, or where did we go wrong in that discourse?
One of the things I guess I hate the most, because we've been ranking sneakers forever, right? Mm-hmm. Like, Joe, this feels like I've been in very contentious arguments before. And some,
you've been in them? Is that a pun based on the name of our social media guy?
Oh, yeah. But, you know, been in a lot of discussions over the years at varying levels of the company. And
yes.
Sometimes it's like, it's always good to get into a room and discuss things, but sometimes I feel like when you get into these rooms and talk about stuff, it's like not as much of a level-headed conversation as it needs to be. And, you know, sometimes it's more about one person cracking on the other without, like, or just dismissing what someone else said about a shoe without anyone like really like going into it in depth.
Lacking nuance.
Yeah.
Don't you think that's gotten better, though, Welty, throughout the years, or no?
A little bit. I mean, if you want to talk about the days of when it was like, it was my first year working at the company, and it's like,
Here comes a dry snitching, but go ahead.
Yeah, Lauren Schlossman being like, if you like those shoes, you're an idiot. And you're like, all right, cool. Like, why are we even arguing anything? You know what I mean? But the 992 argument was tough because it basically came down to the Joe Fresh Goods 992. Not to spoil anything, but that was like what it was centered around. And obviously Joe's collaboration was big for the brand. It brought a lot of new people into New Balance. We had that whole discussion on the podcast. Can't deny any of that. With that said, even Joe talked about it. He's like, you know, the project was a little rushed. Not the biggest New Balance guy himself. And he's like learning about it through the process. So when we're rating the best New Balance product, I think it did a lot for the company, but I just don't think that you can say that it's the best designed New Balance sneaker. To me, it's like it did its purpose. It did what it needed to do for the brand. But if we look back, I think in like 10 years and put all these shoes in a line and we rate them design wise, which do we think was the best put together shoe? I just don't think that sneaker. No disrespect to Joe or anything. I just want to throw that out there. It's has nothing to do with Joe Fresh.
Of course.
It just doesn't hold up to the level of kind of intent with the other sneakers.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people in the Slack felt a totally different way.
Welty and I were kind of on the same side with this, but we are at war with our coworkers in terms of this list. But you know what? We're going to sort it all out, and we're going to make some final calls, and we're going to put that list out there. We're going to tell the people exactly which New Balance 992s are the best and why.
It's just a weird argument when you have people that feel very passionate about New Balance throughout all the years and have you know, been
rocked. You mean yourself?
Or just people I know who are just like the real diehard New Balance collectors who have worked with the brand, have hundreds of pairs of the shoes, can tell you all the little minute differences between all of them. And when they kind of feel some sort of way about the product that's been putting out, and all of that gets erased just because, you know, someone behind a very popular streetwear brand who's doing big things in the space made a hype shoe, that like everything that made New Balance a good brand over all the amount of time just gets erased just because of the hype around one sneaker. I feel like it does a little bit of disservice, because if we're talking about Air Jordans and whatnot, I feel like the people who love Air Jordans wouldn't let that happen if we're ranking what's the best Air Jordan 1 or Air Jordan 4 of all time. I think people would take the discussion a lot more seriously.
Mm-hmm. This is definitely Welty's. For me, it became personal Michael Jordan moment. this is definitely what that is. I could just see him. But yeah, there was a lot of good discussion. And to be honest, I was like letting it, I was just watching from the sidelines a little.
The discussion wouldn't stop. It would pop up over the weekend. Someone would drop another pair of 992s in the Slack, and it's raged for days now, and no end in sight.
Yeah, I'm excited to see how that post comes out and where the group settles. But yeah, the Packer shoes 992. Man, a lot of times you see photos on the internet and they look really good, and then they come and they're like, oh, they look better in the photos. These really mm-hmm. delivered. Not going to lie. I'm so happy Crispy. To have these. And
yeah. Nice looking shoe.
Well, enough about us, though. This week, another great guest. Let's get to it.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Our guest on today's podcast has become one of the UK's most significant fashion designers over the past 5 years. His design prowess stems from a mix of his upbringing in British council estates and his graphic design and illustration chops learned at De Montfort University. As his design portfolio continued to grow, he left an impression on Virgil Abloh, who would end up hiring him to work on a number of projects under the iconic Donda Collective that included everything from Ben Trill, Off-White, Kanye West, Good Music, and more. After soaking up game from the collective of forward-thinking designers he was working amongst, he founded his own label, A Cold Wall, in 2015. The label developed a cult-like following, and a steady building of a loyal fan base would propel the brand to land on the racks at standout retailers like Barney's New York and Selfridges in London. Just 3 years later, in 2018, he would win the Fashion Award for British Emerging Menswear Designer. Since then, his prolificness in the space has led to standout menswear shows and collaborations with Nike, Doc Martens, Oakley, and more. This week, he flipped the iconic Chuck Taylor into a ready-made hiker and retooled a classic basketball silo for Converse. It's our pleasure to welcome one of fashion's brightest young minds to the Complex Sneakers podcast, Samuel Ross. Thanks so much for joining, Samuel.
Thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here with yourselves.
How are you, man?
Really, really well, actually. Really well. That was a really profound introduction, which I'm very appreciative of. And I'm doing well. Of course, we've just released the Converse ERX and the Taylor, which was supposed to be on our .com for 72 hours, but we cleared through 95% of the inventory within, I think, within about 17 minutes or something quite ridiculous.
That's not a surprise for you, though, at this point, right? Blowing out of a sneaker collaboration like that so quick.
It's interesting. It always, there's always this kind of like sense of renewal when it happens. There's always an excitement between the team because we're all of us are kind of in one station operating behind the scenes, ensuring that the flow of sales and revenue and customer experience is, of course, as seamless as possible. So there's always an excitement when you're kind of huddled with your team behind the scenes, making sure people can get the product they want. And that feeling doesn't really ever age. And I'm not sure if a lot of people have kind of talked about what happens on the back end when such a commercial release comes forth. But it's a really exciting time for the team and I as well, of course.
How much do you pay attention to the comments, like when you post that first teaser online? Like, are you just glued to your phone constantly just swiping?
Yeah, I'm a bit of a social media addict, as we all are. So I'm pretty much glued. I'm glued to my phone. And you kind of learn that you're going to get some recoil and damage collateral as you go. But for the most part, the main thing on our side is making sure that the consumers, well, not even the consumers, I don't like that word, the individuals who support the brand can actually access the product. And we know that we were able to launch pretty much right on time. We had a really solid rollout plan and we made sure that the content that went forth across the 7-day rollout period each had different points of inflection. So for example, if you were to look through the posting dates, we're offering multiple views of the product from close, from on foot, from in motion, extreme close-ups, elevated e-commerce shots, as well as more mood and campaign-led shots. So we spend a lot of time, we is literally four of us, making sure that that communication plan gives everyone what they need to kind of see about the product.
Sam, we'll talk more about your Converse project and where you're at now, but also I want to discuss your foundation in footwear. You know, it's so special for us because we don't normally get guests from the UK. So I want to talk about those regional things that you saw growing up, you know, around London and Northampton and things like that. What kind of sneakers were you first seeing when you grew up that made you feel like shoes were important or made you feel like shoes could say something about your identity?
Air Max 95, 97, Air Force mid and Air Force low. 100%. Those were the key silhouettes through and through. And it's interesting because in the UK, you kind of get this like split in terms of material and footwear styles. If you're down south, call anywhere London and beneath, you're pretty much seeing everyone rock, you know, jersey grey, Nike tracksuits, primarily Air Forces, maybe the 95. But as soon as you go to like the Midlands, which would be 70 miles out, 100 miles out of London, it's a completely different threshold of, you know, street style and culture regarding sneakers. And you're into technical nylon, you're into 95s, 98s, Air Max 2001s, you're into the Nike TN, you're into Nike Shop as soon as you cross that threshold. And I was born in Brixton, moved out quite a young age, and I grew up in Northampton, which is like the heart of the Midlands. So I had this exposure to both, you know, the more relaxed jersey, and baggy silhouettes that were more so associated with London and down south and the Air Forces. But I also had that mix of technical apparel and that being reflective in, you know, Air Max styles from up north.
In the UK too, like for a lot of the people don't realize like how much connected the Air Max style is to like street culture and kind of like the connotations with wearing those shoes. Like I think I shared a story on here once. I went to Manchester and was wearing a Nike tracksuit Air Max 95 because I was on a flight. And I went into a pub and like someone like hit me with an elbow because I was kind of like dressed, you know, like a Scally or whatever, or whatever they call it. But I guess like just kind of explain kind of like wearing those shoes and kind of like, you know, the reputation that comes with it.
Sure. It's codex, really. Like it's interesting because it is clearly part of like, you know, subcultural happenings and style tribes. And again, growing up in like a super working class background, which was normal to me, it wasn't even working class growing up. It was just like the normal thing to wear. That's what your older cousins wore. That's what your peers wore. That's what we would try to wear to school, even though we had school uniforms. All of those elements were kind of intrinsic to our identity. But it wasn't really a fashion thing. It was solely like about subculture and street culture and what we knew and what we identified to be our identity at that time. And it still is. And it's interesting looking back, you know, each generation in the UK thinks they're kind of special in regards to what they wear. But we've been wearing the same style codes for the last 25 years. As soon as you get like the early 90s, that's when the Air Maxes and the jersey tracksuits and the technical tracksuits really start to take off. We're in 2020 now. I'm still seeing school kids wear the small Just Do It Nike bags to school in London.
And they all want TNs, right?
Exactly. And I wore that like 15 years back, almost 20 years, not 20 years, but 17 years back or whatnot. So there's a real deep-rooted love for the Air Max, the Air Force, the 95, the TN, and the shocks. And you rightly touched on this idea of, as soon as you put those clothes on, you are assumed to be almost part of a neighborhood or part of an environment. Maybe it's changed a little bit now because, of course, Roadman became like a massive meme like in the last 2 to 3 years. So it's not as specific at it as it was, but it was always deemed as like a more uncultivated approach to dress how we dress and to come from where we came from. And that kind of ties back to this notion, which is complete nonsense, on like chav culture. We were considered chavs. That like we weren't like Burberry pulled so much product so that we couldn't get the product in working class neighborhoods, but we still got the product. So there's always been this association with wearing these clothes and almost being other, but also belonging to like an underground world is the best way to put it. If you dress like that, you were part of a different society almost. And that was fine because we had our own sound wave, we had our own culture, we still have our own language and slang, but it was so different to, you know, the overprescribed view of what it is to be English or British, you know. And to kind of veer off a little bit more, I remember buying my first pair of 95s. They're a counterfeit pair, you know. Okay. I bought them on the...
Did you know it right away when you bought them?
Yeah, I couldn't afford full price. I had £25. I mean, this
what
is
color? What was it, an original color or an off color?
It was an Air Max 180 Limited, and it was white upper. It had a slate gray midsole, and it had a dark red tick on it. And it wasn't really an official colorway.
You didn't smell right.
No, you could look at the front, you know, tooling and see that this was completely off. The eye stay was all over the place. But that's what we knew, and that was my first real engagement with product. It was on council estates, and that's how I started, you know, selling, you know, counterfeit Nikes and Converses off council estates. So it's a really important part of my journey. Sneaker culture was my first foray into fashion.
So I want to know more about this thing where you were selling fake Nike gear. What does that look like? Where do you get it? How much are you selling it for? Is it shoes, apparel? What is that arrangement like?
Both. So over in the UK, we have a system called EMA, which is Emergency Maintenance Allowance for Underprivileged Homes.
Okay.
So I was around 15, 16, just got into what we call college, but what you'd probably just call like the years before you go into university. Mm-hmm. And I started getting EMA. Most of my friends ended up putting their EMA allowance elsewhere into other, you know, directives and directions. And I decided to put mine into really counterfeit clothing and footwear and sneakers. And it's the same notion of you just kind of, when you're from like an area which is quite tight knit, mm-hmm. everyone knows a guy who knows a guy, right? Mm-hmm. And it was just, oh, you're into clothes. I know a guy who sells counterfeit Nikes. Come to the house. We all went to the house. The man sold everything, man, from samurai swords, up ounces of whatever.
Samurai swords?
I mean, it's like a everything house, right? So you're going to get some, like, not to say these were like, you know, beautiful, you know, swords from the Edo period, but just cheap, like painted black, like just anything and everything on a council estate you could get in this house. And the council estate was called the Hemingwell in Wellingborough. For anyone who thinks I might be talking smack, this is a real place, and you can go on Google Map. It will make a lot of sense when you, you know, drop down that small yellow man into the Hemingwell. But anyway, I digress. This guy just sold everything. So I started buying footwear from him specifically. And there was another gentleman I knew, just again from the area, the neighboring town, who was able to get a hold of counterfeit apparel. And, you know, well, not all of it was counterfeit. Some parts were just like off the back of a lorry, and some parts were definitely counterfeit apparel. I just kind of knew people. I mean, a lot of people were either doing that or they were into, you know, finding ways to work with banks and other different. And so, again, when you're just in that environment, all of this is very normal. So it was never a thing like, oh my gosh, you're selling counterfeit goods. It was just like, well,
it wasn't like you were a criminal or you were worried about some. Oh, no,
I was. That was better. That was like the softest option compared to what everyone else was doing. So it was just immediately normalized, and it kicked off quite quick. So I'd have people come to my house and do like fittings, which is
amazing.
Yeah, it's like I've got dudes trying to fit into like a size 30 waist Ivisu who are clearly like a 34. And I'm telling them that the slim fit is what's in right now. And this is like a decade.
Wow, that's amazing. Ivisu. Was it about sneakers that you couldn't get in standard colorways, the fakes, or fakes that look like the original colorways, like Ivisu jeans that look like the real thing, or kind of custom looking ones that people wanted to stand out in?
We were looking for real fakes. You know, okay. People kind of wanted to assimilate in, but the main thing was, it was the price point. We never really talked about the clothes being fake, but we all knew you can't get a pair of Air Max 180s for £25 anywhere else. But it was always about the access to something which looks like the real deal. And again, I spent a lot of time growing up in this small town, working class town. So we were happy with the, you know, mirage and imitation of what the real deal was, because it was so far flung. You know, this is 100 miles out of London. Mm-hmm. So you're not around that kind of velocity and pace of culture moving. So you're kind of, people are happy to get what they can at that point. And we were satisfied at that point.
When you could finally like get the real stuff, where were you going to in the UK? Were you going to like JD Sports, like Sports Direct? Like where were you actually buying the sneakers when you could finally get the real thing?
TK Maxx and JD Sports for sure. I mean, TK Maxx, for you guys, TJ Maxx was like the place where anything was just slightly more abstract that didn't make it from the Energy or Tier Zero collection would end up there. So at the age of 18, we kind of quickly, specifically myself, we quickly clocked onto that. And I would just spend hours just sifting through TJ Maxx to kind of find one of ones, a more particular product, which again, wouldn't typically make it to local JDs or Sports Direct. They were both seminal. Again, for like, if we just needed a pair of Air Force, you go into Sports Direct, you go into JD Sports. But this is where my like perk for, you could say, fashion and sneaker culture started to kind of evolve a little bit. I was always looking for something just slightly different or slightly offbeat, and TK Maxx was able to kind of facilitate that to a certain degree.
Yeah, you find weirder stuff in there that wasn't on the shelves.
Yeah, were there any big come ups at TK Maxx that you can remember?
Yeah, I remember there was a gray, probably like 250 GSM Nike Air tracksuit, which shared the same logo as the Nike Air logo that was put onto a lot of the mid-2010 Jordan brand stuff, which is really interesting. There was a Windrunner jacket that I'm still looking for now that I purchased about 16 years ago. And it was like a lime green colorway with this, like, it looked like a 3D printed fabrication. I've never come across it since and I cannot find it. There are a couple of footwear styles like the ZX300, or maybe it's the ZX300 or 500 from Adidas, was an early pickup in there as well. There was a Nike Air Force. It was Quick Strike. It was slate gray with tons of perforation holes all over it, which was only in a size 12 and I'm a size 10, but I still took that because you know you got me. But, so these are like really, really vivid memories in my mind. And I should probably interject on before kind of getting into selling the counterfeit goods, before discovering what could be found of Tier Zero at TJ Maxx, my first placement at age like 12 or 11 was in a streetwear store in Northampton. So I've always kind of been around these products to a certain degree. That was probably the first point of difference, I'd say, where I was kind of, you know, selling kids and families New Eras on the weekend and running up to the stock room. I was a stock boy. So I've kind of been through all of the different motions of things, you could say.
You've mentioned seeing stuff that was happening in London and that was kind of inaccessible. Was any of that music influenced? I mean, in my teenage years, I was really into grime. So I was seeing Dizzy Rascal wearing Air Maxes on the cover of Boy in the Corner and things like that. Were those the figures that were kind of showing you what was cool in terms of sneakers?
Yeah, they were. Totally. I remember the first day, you know, the I Love You video by Dizzy Rascal came onto MTV. I was 11. I remember turning it on thinking, this is insane to see like someone like us on the TV making this like just like forward thinking music. It was kind of, but again, I think the aspiration of what we didn't have access to was more so from an American perspective. Because I think that when it came to like UK fashion, UK is so compressed, right? And although there's so many different style codes across the different counties and cities and districts, you can still get from like, you know, Manchester, which has a completely different style codex, to London within like 2.5 hours. Mm-hmm. So you can kind of imagine you have families scattered all over the country in specific points, and you all kind of share the same tastes and tendencies regarding fashion and clothing. So from a UK perspective, we definitely did look towards London a little bit more for more like directional tweaks and twists on style. But overall, there was this general sense of, if you are from the UK, if you are from this specific background, you probably dress one of three ways. And we all, you know, ascribe to that. Regarding American influence, we were like profoundly excited by American fashion, music, culture, style. I mean, this is like the 2000s, early 2000s. So this is like peak Americana for us. This is before Wall Street crash. You know, we're kind of looking at America like this like shiny halo object of like profound goodness and commercialization and consumption. And that was what seemed quite far away when you're in a small town, which is not even connected to London. So again, I think that's where this intrigue and drive for like counterfeit goods, whether it be basketball, basketball related on Converse All-Stars, or whether it be related to Evisu or Avericks or Lot 29, we were wanting anything we could grab from that directory. And the majority of it was counterfeit, and we were fine by it, by that.
You have some early Converse memories too, right? You shared a story about seeing a navy blue pair of Chucks in the Caribbean when you were like 14 years old.
Yeah, that was my first pair. It was a pair of navy blue Chucks. It was one star. Couldn't afford the mainline All-Stars, so I didn't have like the circular logo on it. But my background is like, I'm like 1.5 generation. My mother's from the Caribbean. My father's Black, British, Caribbean, but born here. Mm-hmm. So from as young as I can remember, we'd go over every single year for like 2.5 months. So I remember, again, like walking through markets in Barbados and St. Vincent and St. Lucia, walking into these like, well, I guess what you call them now, like parallel selling stores, right? That probably had a lot of overstock and inventory from the South and North Americas, which had kind of ended up in the Caribbean. And you just walk into these stores and there'd just be outlets and outlets and outlets of like, you know, Converse All-Stars. And it's an early memory being able to actually access a Converse abroad. Yeah.
It was basically your version of TJ Maxx, but down there.
Literally that. But it was also like, it was a style thing where everyone just wanted to wear, they were just, that's just what people were wearing. Like, I specifically remember a time where in the UK, again, because the majority of the people I grew up around were also like Black, British, Caribbean, first or second generation. We'd come back from the Caribbean and look at how they were styling the tongues on their Converse All-Stars. Mm. At the time, they fold down the tongue and you'd wrap the lace around the midsole and over the top to hold down like a flap of the tongue.
Right.
And we would take that and then bring that back over to the UK. So there's always been this like tight continuity between Caribbean influence, how we speak, patois, music, and of course, fashion and sneaker culture as well. It's so synonymous for us.
Let's fast forward to 2012, 2013. You meet Virgil Abloh even before he started off white. What was that experience working with him like? I know that I think you met him kind of through Instagram. He followed you back. He saw that you left an impression on him. What was it like to be working amongst him from such an early time in his career as it relates to the brands that we see nowadays so popular?
Yeah, I mean, it was surreal, so surreal, because Virgil's like a brother now at this point, but he was, you know, he was my mentor and my boss for a long time, and we worked really, really hard, and I was really diligent. And I mean, for him, the first engagement was on Instagram. I was trying to email Virgil from a long time before that, through every single channel possible, with like four portfolios, four different creative aliases. This is just when I had... maybe like a year after I graduated and I'd gone straight into industry as a graphic and product designer. Mm-hmm. And I already had a little, like just a sliver of experience, which was enough for me to have like working credentials, you could say. And I think that's what really made the difference between when Virgil did notice my work, he could see there was a level of professionalism and a level of industry experience that hadn't been shaped too much, but was still existent. So I don't think I would have got the opportunity to work with Virgil if I hadn't gone through an academic route, to be honest with you, because you need hard skills. It's not just about being, you know, creative. You need actual skill set to creativity.
Was it the cookware that sold him? Like, didn't you work at a cookware company? Which, like, to me, I could see Virgil being, like, impressed by that, because we see you now for sneakers and fashion, but cookware, there's a design brain that has to go behind that.
Yeah, totally. It was the industrial design focus, 100%, because it's like non-flattering design. And I mean, he trained as an engineer and operated as one for a little while. So it's just like semblance of understanding that like real design is not as flamboyant or as textured as the space we get to work in now, which is just actually quite a blessing that we can make beautiful products and engage with more forward-thinking techniques. But at that point, it was more like raw industrial design. You're working for a salary, you're a product designer, you're a graphic designer, and that was that. And that's what led to me wanting to kind of reach out. I already had a series of small different projects, like a small t-shirt brand was going in Leicester, which is where I studied, and that was picking up traction with local retailers like Wellgosh and Pilot. I was operating as a graffiti artist at night for about a year and a half. I was making short film. So I was kind of just exploring all of these different creative avenues, knowing that I wanted to basically leave product design and actually move into the arts and into just doing things that I enjoyed. You know, life is short.
Samuel, one of the, I think the first moment that kind of noticed your name in the footwear space is a friend of all of ours, Gary Warnett, rest in peace, who I think when your first Air Force One dropped in 2017, I hadn't heard of a cold wall yet, but he was like, no, you really need to pay attention to this shoe. This shoe's really good. And, you know, hearing that from Gary is like the ultimate cosign, especially, you know, in the UK sneaker space, having Gary Warnett say that your Air Force One is good. He wouldn't say that if it sucked, you know? So that was when I first noticed that I needed to pay attention to your brand and your footwear designs. Like, what was it like when that first Air Force One came out? I know it only dropped at the pop-up space initially and was like super limited. Like, how did that come about? What was the reaction like on that?
Yeah, that was a really pivotal moment, to be honest. If you could say the first breakout moment of acknowledgement was working with Virgil, the second main one would have been that Air Force for sure. And
This is in 2017.
Yeah, this is 2017. And I built a really tight rapport with some of the energy team in London at Nike. Of course, like A-Side, Zainab, who's now, which has been at Supreme for a long time. And also Sami Janja, who was, of course, he was in EU Energy, then went over to North America as well. And these were like people who were just kind of around a lot of the energy that was happening in London at that time. And over a long period of time, we just built an organic relationship. I started doing small, you could almost say just marketing stuff for Nike in London. So I developed some packaging for Kim Jones footwear release in 2017 and his apparel release. I did some marketing stuff around the Nike Gyatso Nike 3.0 release, I think it was, in 16, 17, as well, just kind of being like a influencer and part of the community. And then the opportunity came around slowly to start engaging with Nike on more of like a customized one-of-one frontier. And we produced the Air Forces through the bespoke model. And they just blew up really quickly because it was this idea of the shoe's already perfect. All I need to do is allow the shoe to breathe and add a new feeling and texture to the shoe, which was where this notion of actually removing the Nike tick and leaving the preparations came into play. You know, reversing some of the leather skins to have this more coarse but still very subtle and soft texture come into play. The logo size now I'd say is a little bit big for my taste, but at that point, you know, like four and a half, five years ago, it was appropriate for the time in luxury streetwear and that crossover point. Also, we only made 30 pairs at first. So V1, there's a slightly different logo lockup that's been used, and the ACW typographic letters actually connect to the bracket because it's a bit of an error. So if you have that shoe that's literally Gen 1, and there are only 20 or well, 30 of those in existence.
Of the Air Force One High, and then you made more of the Air Force One Highs?
Yeah, but we still only made 150 pairs of the Air Force One High, and they all went through the Nike Energy Bespoke program. So actually, they retailed at a moderately high price point, but no one made any money off those because they, you know, you go through the Bespoke program, your cost price is coming out. Well, your retail should be at 350, but we retailed at around 205, I believe. So Nike made a loss, but it was really important culturally for that shoe to be out at that quality and of that stature from like a British brand and persona, which really encapsulated the moment. But that shoe, as you guys have rightly said, really set the tone for what a Cold War does in footwear, full stop now. That is the crux and foundation of what we do in footwear.
Was it important for you to try and ramp it up from there in terms of production? You've spoken elsewhere about how much you want to build the brand, and you're not afraid to share numbers publicly about how much you're doing in sales every year. Do you have that goal as well with collaborations like your ones with Nike or Converse, where you want to push them to be able to make 10,000, 20,000, 60,000 pairs of the shoes you design with them?
Yeah, totally. And I mean, I'm happy to kind of share some of the quantities on, you know, the Vomeros. So we put out around 87,000 units of the Vomero, which is a pretty big general release, actually. And it still managed to kind of, we managed to clear our units within 24 hours. And then the majority of units cleared within about a 3 to 4 week period, which is a little slower. But then you have to consider that most, you know, tier zero and energy releases, you only have 20,000 units out there. Mm-hmm. I mean, about 20,000 units for the Nike Flylever, and it cleared in 30 seconds. That's a bit of a, this again, not trying to sound arrogant, but that's an easy job to clear that amount of inventory. If we're talking about, you know, 90, 100,000 units, it's almost like a different spectrum of objective in place. Mm-hmm. And I am quite, not fixated, but I like the challenge of being able to kind of push more units and understand what it is, you know, these individuals who support what we do actually want from a shoe. And you've probably seen that if you look at the Air Force, which was a lot more subtle and well-balanced, to the Vomero, which is this spike in eccentricity, down to the Converse, ERX and Chuck, there's like a balance of the two. And I'm always trying to strike this balance of not doing anything too overt, because that's already been established, we've done that, but also trying to push something which is a little bit more experimental and kind of drives a bit more intrigue and question as well.
I feel like that was like a controversial shoe a little bit too, the Vomero with the big heel block on it. It was either some people loved it or some people hated it. Like what was your response to the reaction on putting that on the shoe?
Yeah, with that I wanted to kind of take out the flick knife and kind of stab the dark and be like, we're not going to be doing normal things around here. And I think that was a good stake at doing so. But at that time, I was also in the process of segmenting out different consumer brackets for a Cold War, and establishing more of like an avant-garde directional take, which of course kind of facilitates the Vomero. If you think of some of the runway pieces produced by a Cold War, you can kind of see how the Vomero and that heel tab interlinks right into some of those more abstract pieces. At the same time, you know, the same year we released the Nike AF1 Flylever, which is a more refined
version.
This is
like end of 2018.
Probably about a year after that, 9 months after that. So there's always, you know, going to be this buoyancy of kind of having a pendulum swing between avant-garde on one side, which is way more directional, a bit more challenging, but also having something which is a bit more wearable and user-friendly. And I definitely want to keep that dynamic, though there is, there's always work still on both sides, for sure. And I think that with the Vomero, the one thing I would have changed about that shoe, it's just having more visibility on where the inventory units went when we were allocating for the Vomero and for the AF1 low, because that didn't come about until quite late. And in my opinion, we should have inverted the units. I would have preferred to put out 90,000 units of the Air Force low Flylever and actually 25 units of the Vomero. But obviously, Nike was going
for a change. Why do you have that equation in mind?
Because I always wanted the Vomero to be far more directional and far more inaccessible to a certain degree. I wanted, that was designed to be a shoe which only a certain amount of people wanted to like. I wasn't trying to have everyone like that shoe. It was more so to facilitate the direction side of the brand. But I did want the Air Force fly lever, the low, to be for everyone.
You can have that.
Yeah, I wanted everyone to have that. Everyone feels good in that shoe, right? No one feels conscious about it. But in fact, the units ended up going the other way around, which is why the Vomero became a bit controversial, because there were so many units of it on such like a controversial shoe. It's kind of like, well, why did they do that? And that's the one thing I would have changed, is just having a bit more visibility on the total units going out on that shoe.
I got two questions real quick. One with the Air Force One Low that you did. We talked about the Gary Warnett co-sign, but LeBron James really loved that shoe. I saw him wear it multiple times in the tunnel and even games he wasn't playing. What's it like to, you know, we talk about the shoe selling out, the Converse selling out so quickly, but when you get a co-sign from such an athlete of that stature, what was it like to see him wear the black and white on multiple occasions? Is that something that really, not validates, but you get excited about and psyched about?
Yeah, it's always like, It's just super grateful that, you know, people want to support the work that we kind of spend a lot of time on. And when you see someone like LeBron James wearing the Air Forces, because he was into the highs for a long time as well and was posting them on his main feed before going on to the lows. When you see that, it's almost like a, it just feels good to know that, you know, your concepts aren't always just in your head or at like an inch level and that they can really connect with everyone. Because for me, that's important, man. As much as I like doing some of this, you know, more esoteric work, at the end of the day, I want the Mandem to be able to enjoy the shoes. And it's very important to know that you can still connect with your people then. You know, like LeBron, of course, is of the highest stature, but I have boys back home. Some of my brothers would have the same perspective he has on footwear. So it's always good to know that you've got this through line that's still appreciated and in existence. You know, for me, LeBron represents like the athlete and masculine take on what footwear should be. So I'm always, you know, watching and seeing who's wearing the product and noting down this. We don't really let anything slide on this side. We try to document all of it.
One thing that I like that I've read a lot about you, and I identify this a little bit because I have a lot of pairs of sneakers, but I end up wearing the same 3 to 5 a lot. And you said a quote, I think it was an ID or something. It's not about buying and switching product over. It's living with them. And I feel like the Vomero took on that kind of, you know, after a week, it looks different than after a day. After 10 days, it looks different than after a week. What is that philosophy? And how do we make kind of the young kids who keep everything so pristine sometimes realize that? I totally agree with the sentiment. And I like that you have been kind of you voice that a lot.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure part of this comes from like childhood trauma of not being able to afford a lot of stuff, right? So when you get that one piece of clothing or that one piece of footwear, you will wear that in and you wear it down and you feel like you own the product. I think owning the product is a really important factor here. And it's something from, you know, people who are close to our generation really appreciated this idea of like wearing a sneaker in, having a relationship and story with the sneaker, it being more than just something that you're kind of boxing and keeping fresh to resell. And I guess part of the joy that comes from like the first time I could ever buy a pair of Jordans or that first time I ever bought a pair of Converse and wearing them through and through everywhere. I want people to feel that, because that's what has kind of taken us all to this place of being able to articulate and communicate the quality of footwear to a certain degree. And for me, that emotional connection to the product is actually important. Like I've got a pair of Nike Freeze that released maybe 2.5 years ago, 3.0s, I believe. They've got a hole in the front, man, but they're great. I'm still trading them every day. Do you know what I mean? Because that shoe is not coming out again and I want to wear this shoe. Perfect, it's comfortable. So I'm an advocate for people wearing their footwear and the footwear having like a life and a personality. I understand, you know, the necessity and the opportunities given by like people reselling. I'm not against it either, but at the same time, the product is there to be enjoyed.
Speaking of things that, you know, probably won't wear, things that would resell for a lot, you ended up getting Damien Hirst to do a 101 pair of the Vomeros. Like how the hell does that happen? Like
it's mad, because we were joking like, oh, let's gift Damien Hirst a pair. And then a good friend of mine, Skinny, who does a lot, he calls him, he's classed as a flaneur, as he calls himself, but he does a lot of bits and pieces culturally with sportswear, footwear, music. He ended up getting a pair to Damien Hirst, and then he just painted them and sent them back to Skinny. And we were just like, this was a running joke.
How did this happen?
But then the through line kind of makes sense because Damien Hirst's son, Cass, who customizes Air Forces, Cass Hirst,
yeah,
a big clientele. Him and I ended up connecting in Chicago, actually, for Virgil's MCA exhibit and retrospect. So we ended up building a really strong rapport over there, connected, sent him some footwear, I believe, and he probably spoke to his father and they ended up working on that pair of shoes or whatnot. And I think there's only maybe like one or two pairs in existence.
Did you wear a hole into those yet?
You know what? I've got a pair that are so mashup, they can't even come on screen right now.
Wow. I love that.
I feel like I need to add in the story of like the Solarized Vomeros, because that completely...
Oh, I love that shoe.
Oh, yes.
That completely reignited the whole narrative in place. And I think that was a real learning curve for me on how close I need to be to all kind of processes when developing footwear. Because getting to the Solarized colorway was a lot closer to developing the Air Force High. I was there for every single incremental step of it. And of course, those were all hand-dyed in London, one of ones, resin dipped and signed by myself. So we kind of...
Beautiful shoe.
Thank you. And we really wanted to, again, add that more personable, almost like organic feeling to the shoe and almost have like a wabi-sabi nature in place. And sometimes you can't produce that through, you know, like a mainline offering, the same way the Air Force High couldn't be done on like a global release, the same way the Solarize could never be done on a global release. Some things need to be really specific and kept quite particular.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting though, from a design standpoint, I know some of these things are dictated by circumstance, but the Vomero in the way that you want people to wear, it almost seems like a reaction to the Air Force One, because you think about how people wear Air Force Ones and they want to keep them so clean and crisp and perfect. And even that first Air Force One you did was inaccessible to a degree because of how limited it was. But then you have this Vomero that you're telling people, please wear this, please beat this up, please destroy this.
Totally. And I've seen some amazing screenshots. I mean, every now and then I go on like a posting spree of posting like 12 worn out Vomeros and they look absolutely stunning, man. I'm telling you, like the level of like deterioration in character that people understood I wasn't, you know, and I'm going to mind myself on profanities here, but people understood that I wasn't, you know, chatting Bob about this. They know that I wasn't making it up. They could see that aging process. Everything that was said that shoe released actually happened within a 12-month cycle. And for me, that's quite important because I know that I can get quite iterative with my, you know, with my thoughts and words, but for people to see the foundation of what I was saying about an aging process happen through wear and take that step in trust with me as a designer is really fulfilling when they get the product that they want at the end of that as well.
Going on now you're moving to the Converse projects, you know, you have the Chuck Taylor, which is like a hiking boot rendition, and you have the ERX, which is completely different from the original. How do you convince the brand, like you did with the Vomero, but like, I want to take some of your most iconic shoes and just totally make it look like it's not even that sneaker?
I think that for me is this thought of like, if Nike or Converse or any collaborator wants to actually work with a designer, then the designer should be doing some design work and not just kind of, and again, it's not bashing. It's just how I personally feel about design, probably because A, studied it, B, worked in the field before, but you're supposed to leave a mark on the product. And I think that when you just spend a lot of time working with their design teams, because I actually really care about what their teams think and their, you know, ideation process and just working closely with them, you want to leave an imprint on the opportunity to work with some of these super brands. And again, for me, it kind of goes back to sifting through TJ Maxx or seeing really specific particular product. That's always what's engaged me. And I want to make product like that because I know that's going to stimulate other people. And it is important to have product which is directional and abstract out there and a bit more challenging to push the pen forward for everyone. Or we're just going to end up with like logos just placed on shoes that we used to like. It's important to have that experimentation in there for sure. Like I've got one of the original ERX samples here, and it's got like the black locking as well. And you can see that some of the embossing on the logo is nowhere near as sharp. And we went over like series of iterations, even on the back here. I don't know if you can see. Yeah, you can see that the etching is a lot smaller here as well. And obviously, there's a series of changes. This has elasticated laces as well, but we found them too constraining for the shoe, so we took those off. But again, it's always about having different processes. And then there's this other one as well, in a different colorway, which is super exciting. So there's always a process of moving forth and making sure that the shoes have something to say if I'm going to work with a partner who I really respect.
Yeah. How limited are they this time around?
These aren't that limited. We've tried to go for more of like a general release. So we have, I think we took around 25,000 units on our .com. In terms of general release, I don't have the specific number across every region because of the way that Converse distribute to their wholesale partners.
Mm-hmm. When doing all these daring things on the shoes, has there ever been a time where the brand told you, no, you can't do that?
No, not so far. I think typically the design teams are quite stimulated by this idea of, wait, this isn't a general release shoe. This isn't solely about, you know, driving revenue. It's probably linked to a marketing budget. So there's probably, I would assume they see it as like a way to kind of get some more experimentation or workout. But then saying that, like, Converse and Nike are both really experimental brands when it comes to footwear, to be fair. And I mean, their teams like Nate, Joe, Asher, Shamis, Neek, all of these lot are really on like the forefront of footwear design anyway, with like ISPA. And so there's never a pushback. It's almost like just like working with your family. And I guess, again, the difference there is we all come from like a design discipline versus like a high fashion discipline, or from like a more cultural influencer perspective. So there's the same language that's constantly being, you know, spoken to a certain degree.
You've talked about how willing they are to push things, but I feel like in terms of with outside collaborators, they weren't really that way until Virgil kind of kicked down the door. You know, you think about Kanye West and his Yeezy line years ago, and he was complaining about not being able to do a bunch of shoes. And then I feel like Virgil, who you worked under, kind of changed that narrative for young Black designers, where Nike would be willing to give them a bunch of leeway or a bunch of freedom to do a bunch of shoes and really drastically change them, you know?
Completely. Yeah, completely aligned. He showed that more experimental take can actually drive revenue, which of course opens up a lot more risk-averse conversations for Nike and for myself and other, you know, young designers and designers of color to kind of actually really have a take on what footwear design can look like in the future. And again, they've always been hyper supportive, even down from, you know, offering the bespoke Air Force One, which really kicked off the story. They've always found, whether it be the local teams or the Portland HQ, they've always found ways that, which are quite dynamic, to make sure that there is an opportunity to work with them and building like a long-term relationship. And that's why I kind of say it's more like, it feels closer to like a family, because I've known, you know, some of these people who've been at these companies now for like, talking like eight or 9 years now. And it's only in the past 3 years products have come forth, because you can't just force your way into these conversations. You just have to be diligent and produce, you know, work that you care about. And if people respond to it, then the ideal is that opportunities come about. But there's no like hack or cheat code to kind of get into designing crazy shoes. You just got to put the time in. Again, I started as a shop boy at 12. You know, to counterfeit shoes, to then a small t-shirt line, to then working under Virgil. That's like an 18-year journey, pretty much.
Do you consider it at all part of your journey being from Northampton, a place that historically shoemaking was a big part of their industry? Is that part of your story at all, or is that separate from what you want to do in sneaker design?
I think it's part of it. I mean, it's something that was always just kind of discussed and spoken about. Like the town I went to school in, we used to walk past the Doc Martens factory every day. So it's just ingrained in your head. I mean, if you think about like British footwear, kickers is really popular amongst like school kids, especially from Jersey background. So it'd be kickers or Doc Martens on your feet, ideally. And then you'd have like a small Nike backpack with like black Nike gloves with a small tick, the golf gloves. Mm-hmm. So And you'd have probably like a nylon holster bag as well. So there's always been this like working in of shoes into subculture. And I guess that's just kind of something that I've kind of carried forth, you know?
I think we just need to clarify too for the listeners. I know we've said it multiple times. When we say tick, you mean swoosh. I know in the States, it's like there's
no, nah, they'll get it, right?
It's just funny because there's always the conversation of the, you know, the UK slang terms versus the US slang terms, sneakers versus trainers and all that.
I've had Nike HQ be like, it's a swoosh. I'm like, it's a tick, man. We call that a Nike tick, but yeah, you're right. We are referring to
it. It's funny. I go on a bunch of like Adidas like Facebook groups in the UK and whatnot, and they always like the slogan I always hear is like ticks are for dicks. Like people who don't like Nike, and it's just kind of funny to see the differences in our sneaker cultures, you know?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, even what you guys referred to as like the, I think it was the Air Max, we called them 110s for a long time, just because that's what the RIP price was. So there were always these like small little differences here and there. And your uptowns, you think I heard the word uptown in London or Birmingham? small differences, you know?
Wait, what were you calling them?
We just called them the Air Force High or Air Force Mid. That was it.
You weren't calling them the Brixtons or the Croydons or something?
Nah, we didn't get that far.
Yeah. One thing too, I wonder how democratizing do sneakers feel to you? Because I feel like your brand is so much about the separation between classes and things like that. And it's sometimes working in sneakers, it feels like sneakers is one through line, or it has become more recently something that people across classes enjoy and interact with in the same way. Do you think about sneakers like that?
Yeah, totally. It is. I mean, you said it all. It is such a concise through line with sneaker culture, being able to kind of, I mean, just kind of connect and introduce and be a gateway into high fashion. I see it as a gateway. I also see it as a point of attraction that, again, I don't really have anything else to say on that, like that all classes and all ages and different generations, you know, enjoy, like boomers, Gen Z and millennials all enjoy sneakers and footwear. Mm. You know, it's just one of those things. Like my dad, I recently gave him a pair of ISPAs and he loves them. It's like, there's this thing about footwear which just brings out the, I guess it's almost like a childhood memory to that first unboxing you ever had. And it just can't be, it's irremovable. It's almost like, you know, footwear is so much a representation of the first stages of wealth acquisition. And interestingly enough, one's position within like a local community from a societal perspective. So it's always going to be an important through line, you know, and there's something beautiful about that. Like there's a quote in Top Boy, which is so true. And Deshaun, it's in series one, Sean, the main protagonist, says, "Where I'm from, to show you get you have money, the first thing you do is put on a fresh pair of kicks, not anything else." And it's so true. Like that idea of being box fresh on like your first day of college or school or whatever, or that feeling when you got that fresh Nike tracksuit on and you got your fresh Air Forces on, there's nothing like it, and everyone can relate to that.
Mm-hmm. Before we go, Samuel, I want for you to settle the debate, but you bring up the ISPA, and I've been around a lot of designers who are like, this shoe is amazing. I saw that you kind of debuted a new colorway on your Instagram. You said that you gave it to your dad. What about that shoe do you really love?
The fact that it could even be commercialized to me is insane. Let alone the fact that the majority of the materials are recycled and within like a closed loop system at Nike is really, really quite profound. And I'm going to be speaking a lot about ISPA and Nike NDE and some other Nike programs in the next couple of weeks. We've been working on some stuff around ISPA, which is quite substantial.
New Nike collab?
No comment. There's lots of conversation.
Let him get through Converse week first, right, Samuel?
Yeah. I'm not committing to that for no headline, but there's a really tight rapport, and we're always working on something.
That's awesome, man. Anything else that we didn't touch on that you would like to touch on? It's been great talking to you.
I think the main thing to touch on is that it's going to be exciting to see that a lot of people are going to get an opportunity to actually get their hands on this Converse release. And of course, it's really exciting to work at a more I mean, this is in context, obviously, but a more democratic price point, whereas typically our mainline footwear is like 250, 300. Air Forces were above 200. The Vomeros were the high 100s. Now we have, you know, the Chuck Taylor, which is at 120, 130. Mm-hmm. It was good to kind of take a step towards democratizing the price points. And that's something I want to do a lot more of with these partnerships as well.
Actually, there's one more thing I want to bring up. Sam, when is the jewelry coming? I've been waiting for the Cold Wall jewelry for a minute now. It looked like it was going to happen, and then I feel like it never materialized. I love the clothes, but I always have trouble fitting them on my awkwardly shaped body. But I feel like if I could just get a ring or a bracelet or, you know, something like that.
You're not going to be disappointed. We've got the SS21 film debuting in about a week from now, and we've spent a lot of time on jewelry, a lot of time.
I'm going to be in your Instagram comments if I don't see any jewelry.
It's going to be there. Send me, DM me your address, and we'll make sure we have to fling something true to you. So right.
This guy always finds his way to finesse.
Look at the finesse.
I'm not finessing. No. Hold on.
With 30 seconds left in the fourth quarter, he's going to finesse something.
This was not a finesse. It was a genuine appreciation for this man's resume. Okay.
This is Brendan Dunn's version of getting the follow back from Verdun.
Yeah, right.
Just to bring it all full loop.
To be honest, though, I do need, and again, even offline, I do need to get you guys sizing so we can get you some stuff regarding just like apparel, track suits, honestly. So please hold me to that, and we'll make sure the teams connect on that one.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Congratulations on such a big week. Congratulations on all your accolades. We're looking forward to all the projects you have coming up, and know it's a busy week for you. So thanks so much for joining us for this hour or so.
No, much appreciated for the time, guys. Really appreciate it.
Our producer is Dave Matthews. Our associate producer is Jasmine Plata. Sound engineering done by Kyle Garvey. Special thanks to Jennifer Stewart and Shiva Bayet. The Complex Sneakers Podcast is a production of the Complex Podcast Network.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.